drug treatment and education and support for the communities from which they come. So we need to end the war on drugs and the war mentality that we have, which means ending zero tolerance policies. It means transforming our criminal justice system from one that is purely punitive to one that is based on principles of restorative and transformative justice. Systems that take seriously the interests of the victim, the offender, and the community as a whole. We need to abolish all of the laws that authorize legal discrimination against people who have criminal records, legal discrimination that denies them basic human rights to work, to shelter, to education, to food. We have to decriminalize, immigration. We have to grant the right to vote, not just to people upon release from prison. I have trouble with, the framing of this as being a movement to end, disenfranchisement laws and say we should be allowing people in prison to vote like many other Western democracies do. There are, often voting drives within prisons in other Western democracies. And here in the United States, we deny people the right to vote not only when they're in prison, but, often when they're out and sometimes for the rest of their lives. So there is so much work to be done in transitioning from a war mentality to a mentality where we extend care, compassion, and concern to poor people and people of color and not, respond with a purely punitive impulse.
Well, Michelle Alexander, we thank you so much for being with us. The conversation continues. Her book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration, The Age of Colorblindness. She is a law professor at Ohio State University in Columbus. She'll be speaking tonight at Union Theological Seminary, the Judith Moyers Lecture, and on Friday night at the Columbia University Conference, Beyond the Boars, Transforming Injustice. Democracy Now! Is hiring a part-time camera operator to work on a live broadcast. Visit democracynow.org for more information. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berker, Nate Felsar, Mate Nirmit Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Honey Masood, Ravi Karen, Dina Gesder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with our host, Paul Rowland.
Hi, everyone. It is International Women's Day.
On this wonderful International Women's Day.
And International Women's Day.
You're listening to International Women's Day here at KBOO.
International Women's Day. This Sunday, March 8th, 24 hours of all women's programming right here on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 25th Cascade Festival of African Films, happening Thursdays through Sundays, now through March 8th, in celebration of Black History Month at Portland Community College Cascade Campus. The theme this year is Africa Through African Lenses, and features the films Half of a Yellow Sun, Finding Fela, Lessons of Basketball and War, Under the Starry Sky, and many more. That's the 25th Cascade Festival of African Films at PCC Cascade, 705 North Killingsworth in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
As citizens of a so-called democratic society, we need to have information that ranges from A to Z, not what we have, which is A to B.
KBOO is proud to present An Evening with David Barsamian, Wednesday, March 4th, 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. All proceeds will benefit KBOO Community Radio. One of America's most tireless and wide-ranging investigative journalists, David Barsamian is the host of Alternative Radio. Again, that's An Evening with David Barsamian, Wednesday, March 4th, at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in Wednesdays for an afternoon of jazz. Hosts of Jazz Lives, A Jazz World, and Jazz in the Afternoon play the very best in jazz music. From the historical to the present, and jazz of all stripes. Swinging, smoking, bluesy, funky, new and old, but all good. That's Wednesday afternoons from noon to 4 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, and accessories with a focus on natural fibers since 1984. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at GazelleNaturalFiberClothing.com.
Overdue green, 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 green machine. On veut des tours d'avion, des Airbus, du diesel, des mandarines toutes les saisons, des grands voyages dans le ciel, du high-tech à la maison, de la nouvelle technologie. On veut pouvoir dire pardon et soulager son esprit.
On veut de la viande d'Argentine, de la biloche à tous les repas, de la world food dans la cuisine. On veut du sucre, on veut du gras, on veut moins cher, on veut meilleur, on veut toujours un peu d'ailleurs.
On veut la mer, on veut l'été, même en hiver, on veut bronzer.
On veut du
and good morning. You are listening to KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio. My name is Paul, and I'll be with you for the next hour. And that was a song. I wish we could understand those French lyrics. That was a group called Trio. I just kind of found them, put in the word greenwashing on YouTube, and I guess it's only the French who are taking that on. So greenwashing is kind of one of the themes we're going to be taking on today. My host is Mike. My guest is Michael Donnelly. Morning, Michael.
Good morning, Paul.
How are you doing this morning?
Pretty good. Pollens are getting me, but pretty good. A little early this year.
So you were on, around this time yesterday morning on the other community radio station here in Portland, X-Ray, with on Carl Wolfson's show. How'd that go?
I thought it went really well. Yeah, very well.
Yeah, I just want to give a shout out to X-Ray. They're been on the media landscape for about a year now, I guess, somewhere around there. And some might think that there's some sort of competition, for listenership and funding between a town have two community radio stations? Well, apparently so. I think it's just great having some more diversity on the radio dial. It's such a bleak prospect when you turn up and down the radio dial. So it's good to have some other interesting stuff out there. So just a shout out to X-Ray and having on my old friend Michael Donnelly on the Carl Wolfson show. So you were talking about what we're going to be talking about the name of one of your articles you just had on Counterpunch, Oregon's Governor and the Grifters, in parentheses, Green Crony Capitalism. And the other one, Oregon Governor Brown's to-do list, a Herculean task. And that's obviously a subject that is all over the media now with the resignation of Governor Kitzhaber and the appointment of a new governor in his place. But a lot of people aren't necessarily on the progressive side talking that much about what really led to this? I think maybe people are in a little bit of shock, you think?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, crony capitalism is what led to it. In this case, green crony capitalism. And we're so used to the fossil fuel crony capitalism of the Dick Cheney types that when it happens on our side, we're in shock. We're in kind of disbelief, It almost reminds me of the parishioners that can't believe that the choir master was diddling the choir boys until the plea bargain comes down.
And let's talk about our history, because we go way back. We go back to the mid 1980s, and when you were involved in the Brighton Bush, and I got involved in the forest issue way back then, and you know, you have in your article about Kitzhaber's resignation, you talk about when you first met Kitzhaber. So why don't you tell that story, and then we'll talk about how I got to know you back then.
Right. I'm one of the people that in the early days restored Breitenbach Hot Springs and turned it into the highly successful worker-owner cooperative that it is today. But back in the Reconstruction era in the mid-80s, one night I happened to catch some people sneaking into the hot springs, and it ended up being John Kitzhaber, two other state senators, and a state representative and some of their aides. So we were just at that point in the midst of the whole ancient forest campaign just exploding. We were back to the land hippies hiding out from the world, but then the world came to us in the form of industrial forestry, and scars were appearing on the hillsides around us. We were waking up in the morning to chainsaws and trees crashing and so on and so on. So, I recognized who these people were. In fact, one of them was our senator, and the representative was our representative from Breitenbach. So instead of kicking them out, I hopped in the hot tubs with them and spent the time basically lobbying them and trying to get them on board to help us out on fighting off the assault from just the hardcore industrial forestry that was going on around us.
So you think they listened?
I think they did listen. And the follow-up on that is a few years later, Kitzhaber had become the Senate president, and George Atiyah, who's I want to say something about George. George is one of the great heroes of Opal Creek, and he's recovering right now from a plane crash that miraculously he survived, but he's having a long recovery back. He's back here in Portland living at home, and lots of friends and people are plugging in and helping George. But George was a genius, and because of his connection to politics, his uncle was the governor for a while, Vic Atiyah. George knew the system, and he came up with a plan that the Forest Service, the state would pass a bill seeking the Forest Service to lease Opal Creek to the state for $1 a year to become a wilderness state park. And there's a precedent for that, because numerous state parks in the state are leased land from the Forest Service. It was a brilliant strategy. Kitzhaber introduced it for us, got all sorts of people on board with it. There was a huge hearing in the state capitol, and Big Timber gave the workers the day off. They came down and surrounded the capitol with log trucks, gridlocked the city of Salem. It was a huge deal. The entire capitol was filled with people. George was assaulted on the steps by a group called Women in Timber. Luckily, some of his timber buddies, we had quite a number of friends who were in the timber industry. I was a timber worker before Breitenbach. George was a timber worker too. So, but we showed our slideshow juxtaposing all the pictures of beauty versus the clear cuts. When it ended, the Capitol was stunned into silence. We knew right then and there that Opal Creek wasn't going to get cut. It took a few more efforts. That didn't go forward, but eventually now it's a 35,000 acre, highly beloved wilderness.
It's important to, to recognize it, these places, just not to take granted that some of these places that people love, people go down Opal Creek, people go to Breitenbach, and they just sort of, it's always been this way, and, you don't even know the backstory that that actually those areas could have been completely clear-cut, completely devastated, just like most of the rest of pretty much all the rest of low elevation, old growth forest in the Northwest, and most of the low to mid-level elevation old growth. So yeah, yourself and George Atiyah and many others had a lot of—
Yeah, literally thousands.
Had a share, thousands and thousands of people. And so that's how we got involved. As you said, people know Breitenbach as the Breitenbach Hot Springs and Retreat Center down there near Detroit, Oregon, of course. And I got involved there in November of it's been about 30 years, about November of 86. Yeah. I showed up one evening and they said, we need someone to sit up in the tree. So I had brought a hammock and a sleeping bag, and I said, okay, I'll do it. Anyway, so I got up there, and then I came down and got arrested, and met you and the rest of the crew. And there's still a few more years before most of the Brighton Bush drainage ended up getting protected.
Yes. Yeah.
And so that's how we got to know each other, full disclosure. And so, you know, you've been fighting against the clear cutting of Oregon's forests for all these years, and you've been living in Salem, so you're close to the center of power, so you've obviously been an observer of the Oregon political scene. Of course, you come from Michigan originally.
Yep.
From Flint, right?
From Flint, Michigan, yes. Yeah.
So
quite a bit different than here.
Quite a bit different than here. So you've watched from afar as and from up close when you go back, the continual disintegration of America's ex-industrial cities. But that's another story for another time.
Right.
So here in Oregon, in the area that, you know, as we said, we saved a precious few places from the ravages of industrial logging. So let's cut to the current. You know, there's been governors and politicians have come and gone. You mentioned some of them in your article. There's been, you know, some people who've had a Republican or Democrat who've had some sort of moral center of gravity or kind of ethical center. You know, obviously most politicians are fairly limited in the scope of what they can do, but at least if they have some sort of sense of ethics in their personal and political life, they can perhaps do less harm. Mm-hmm. Let's put it that way. You talk about some of the politicians and their records before we get right into Kitzhaber. Who have you seen that is, who have you had some respect for in Oregon politics?
Well, if we want to look just at governors in the state, you know, if you go way, way back in time, Governor Oswald West is a hero because he went after some of the timber barons that had stolen a lot of the public land and actually got some of it back. There's a great book called Looters of the Public Domain. It's kind of a jailhouse confessional written by one of the conspirators and really lays that out. But Governor Oswald West was able to get back about 70,000 acres that were on the block that had been stolen. And of course, he's the governor that first was able to set aside the beaches of Oregon. And there's a state park on the coast. In fact, it's the only place in Oregon where there's old growth forests that are west of Highway 101. But if you come into the modern era, Governor Tom McCall is far and away head and shoulders above all the rest as far as environmental champions for the state. You know, there's so many things that he had a hand in, the bottle bills, this, that, and the other. In fact, he actually had the state police padlock pulp mills until they quit dumping dioxin into the Willamette River. He was an unbelievable environmental governor. I mentioned Vicatia before. Governor Vicatia is the only governor that actually used his power to set aside waterways as state scenic waterways. The only one. He did everything he could to save the Lower Deschutes River, the Little North Fork Santiam River. He's absolutely revered by the tribes in the state for what he's did for the tribes. He helped get some of the tribes reestablished.
After the termination era.
When he was first elected to the legislature, Vicatia succeeded in getting a bunch of racist provisions removed from our Constitution. If you ever read the original Oregon Constitution, it's appalling. He did that. He also started the nation's first statewide food bank. So yeah, Vic's someone I highly admire. Barbara Roberts, she was only governor for one term, but she was clearly on our side as far as trying to conserve resources and go about it in the right way.
So let's talk about Kitzhaber. So Kitzhaber, you know, I hear people, you know, in the environmentalists talk about, you know, Kitzhaber being, you know, against coal terminals and, you know, being an environmentalist type. And certainly his partner, Sylvia Hayes, certainly put on a veneer of being an environmentalist. Let's try to get behind that veneer. Let's talk about your take on what, you know, what brought down Governor Kitzhaber.
Okay, here's how I see it. Back in 2007, the legislature adopted, and it was signed into law, a policy called the 25 by 25 Renewable Energy Portfolio. And that required that the retail power coming out of the grid, 25% of it by the year 2025 would have to come from renewable sources. And, you know, how we define renewable sources is part of this problem. But it happened all over the country. Many states have some version of this. It's 20 by 20 or 10 by 20 or 25 by 25. We have one of the highest ones. And then what ended up happening is, as a result of that, all of a sudden there was these huge pots of tax money to tap, federal and state money, to encourage the development of the, you know, the renewable energy infrastructure. And since that time, if it's hard to tell, but it appears that the state's put out over $550 million in tax credits and grants, and billions in government-backed loans to build new facilities. And that's what I see is what led to the downfall of Kitsopper, was that the tapping those pots of money ended up being green crony capitalism.
So who do these tax credits go to?
Well, if you're a company and you want to set up a solar plant or a wind farm or something, that's who gets them. Mm-hmm. You know, some wind farms, they put a limit on it at $10 million in tax credit. And the way a tax credit works is, if you make enough income that your company owes taxes, you can write it off against these tax credits. If you had $10 million worth of taxes, you would owe nothing if you cashed in your tax credit. How it actually works in practicality is, the companies turn around and they monetize the tax credits, meaning that they can sell them. If your company didn't make any money and you have no tax liability, you can sell it to another company that does. And generally, that $10 million tax credit will be sold at a discount to the other company for, say, $7 million. They'll take $10 million off of their tax with it and pocket the other $3 million. And that's the underlying game. And it's a huge game. It's like the game in town. If you look at the legislature right now, there's 15 current bills introduced in the House that would extend and expand these tax credits at a time when we should be reeling them in. Partly because, well, when we get into my Governor Brown's to-do list, I'll talk about what she needs to do to audit this whole system. But that's the underlying thing to me. You know, it's similar to the Columbia River Crossing project. All of a sudden, there was this big pot of federal tax money to be tapped. And tap it they did. At least $175 million got spent. There's no bridge, you know.
Well, talk about Sylvia Hayes and the Energy Foundation and some of these other connections that became so problematic.
All right. Well, Sylvia Hayes started her own company, 3E Strategies, which was a company that was basically to lobby for these other companies to get the tax credits and get set up. And that's what her function was. It got to the point where, okay, all of a sudden, you know, she's the governor's partner, fiance. She's got an office in his office she's working out of. She's running her consulting business out of the state offices. She's using the title as first lady. She's actually using government employees as her subordinates in all of this. And then we find out that she's advising the governor on energy policy. She had a big hand in writing the energy policy. If you read some of the emails that have been leaked, she wanted a lot of credit for that too. But we find out at the same time she's doing this lobbying and she's working out of the governor's office, she's getting paid by various nonprofits to represent their interests. So what ended up happening, and this is what I think really brought them down, was an organization was created, a sham think tank called the Clean Economy Development Center, set up in Washington, D.C. And as far as we can tell, Sylvia Hayes was the only fellow this organization ever had. She was paid at least $118,000 that she admitted that she was paid to lobby on behalf of these companies through this organization. That's the money she did not report on her IRS taxes. The Clean Energy Development Center itself never filed any taxes, and the IRS stripped them of their status after 3 years. So everything was kept under the table, and none of this ever came out. And then if you dig a little bit further, by the way, I think the top two pieces of political advice of all time are follow the money, that FBI agent Mark Felt, known as Deep Throat during the Watergate. And the other one is from Upton Sinclair. It's difficult to convince a man of something when his salary depends on not being convinced or understand something. And if you look at those two things, they tie in everywhere. So if you follow the money, the Clean Energy Development Company got major support.
Clean Economy Development.
Clean Economy, Center. Right. Yeah, they're kind of interchangeable in their stages. But yeah, the Clean Economy. They got a lot of funding from something called the Energy Foundation. And this is a nonprofit that was set up by a billionaire hedge funder, Tom Steyer, from California, who you'll be hearing a whole lot more about. He plans to run for Senate for next year when Barbara Boxer retires in 2016. He plans on running. He's become a big funder for the Democratic Party, and he's been funding a lot of this alternative energy industry, as well as the lobbying that goes on for it. So the Clean Energy the Energy Foundation, as a result of all this, if you look at the sweeping subpoena that the feds jumped in and put in, it's one of the entities that's had all its records subpoenaed on this. There are other groups and nonprofits. The Rockefeller Brothers Fund is one of them that really funds a lot of this clean energy stuff. And they're all tied into this, you know. And like I said, it was clearly just set up just to influence Sylvia Hayes and to pay her to influence our government to hand out more of these millions and millions in tax credits.
So how about the Apollo Alliance? They seem to have something to do with that 25x25 renewable energy.
Yeah, they have everything to do with that. The Apollo Alliance is another nonprofit that was set up by a lot of the same entities. And they're the group that was sent around state by state by state to get them to adopt the 25x25 renewable energy portfolio.
Okay, now, so there's so much to talk about this. There's so many aspects. So what's really wrong with them? You know, we want to move towards renewable energy. You know, we need funding for this. So what's wrong with this picture?
Wow. Okay. I'm all in favor of trying anything we can try at this point. You know, I mean, things are a desperate situation. But efficacy is the key, you know. And I've myself installed 6 solar systems. I've been involved in 2 small hydro systems at Opal Creek and Brighton Bush. I support using it, but the reality of it is we've spent these $510 million on this. And as far as that 25x25 goes, we're at 4.7% coming from the alternative sources. How are we going to get to 25x25 10 years from now? Well, if you dig deeper, it's biomass. That's the burning of trees for electrons. And if you dig really deeply, that's what's really going on here. The efficacy of wind and solar hooked to the grid, you know, at the consumption rates we have now, the best we can do is just make up the increase in consumption. You know, we really obviously need to lower consumption, power down quite a bit to even get to anything imaginably sustainable. My line I like to say is we could power the grid on unicorn farts, but if we keep consuming the same way, we're still going to eat the planet, you know. So when you look into the biomass part of it, that's what interested me as a forest advocate. That's what got me really digging into it. There's all these plans. Kitsopper and the state land board decided on a plan to double the logging on state forests. They sold off 1,500 acres of the state forest to Seneca Sustainable Energy. It's a timber company, Seneca Timber, which now has Eugene's largest polluter.
Now if that's not a greenwash
name,
Seneca, right? Sustainable Forest.
Yeah, I think it's spelled Sustaina, B-U-L-L. It's the number one polluter, you know. And guess what? They get carbon credits for burning trees as if that's not polluting. It's 1.5 times dirtier than burning coal. That's how bad it is. And this is a worldwide problem, you know. Germany and England are importing ground-up Amazon forests and ground-up southeastern United States forests, burning them for electricity, getting the carbon credits for it, and then using the carbon credits to offset increased coal use. That's how bad it is. But if you dig into Oregon politics, the biggest thing going on today are these plans to up the logging on our state forests and up the logging on our federal forests. Congressman Peter DeFazio is behind a huge plan to up the logging on the on the west side for us. And Senator Ron Wyden has had a plan that would thin out 9 million acres of public forests in eastern Oregon. At the same time, the Kitsap administration was able to secure a $1.2 billion government-backed loan and grants to a new biomass plant in eastern Oregon. And if you look at the Boardman coal power plant, which people have successfully got to PGE to claim they're going to take it offline and quit burning coal, that's Oregon's biggest polluter, biggest carbon polluter. There's movement afoot to convert it to biomass by 2020. And so it's a raid on the forests in the name of renewable energy is what got me involved, and it's at the heart of all of this.
So it's a lot to take in. My guest is Michael Donnelly, longtime forest activist and government politician watcher in Salem. And you are listening to KBOO Community Radio. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. My name is Paul Rowland, and we're halfway through the show, and I have not yet given out the number. This is a call-in show, if you hadn't noticed. And the number to call in and ask your question or make your comment is 503-231-8187. And that's 503-231-8187. And you mentioned the state land board, and of course, our new governor, Kate Brown, as Secretary of State, was on the state land board. And what was her role in, you know, the whole issue of state forests and movement towards biomass and all that?
I see her role as just being a rubber stamp for Kitsoppers on the land board. Uh-huh. And the same with the state treasurer, Ted Wheeler. Though I have to admit, I went to a number of these hearings, and he was by far the most gracious and willing to meet with the people that were opposed to it.
Well, so do you think that does not bode well for Kate Brown as governor in terms of these issues?
I think it's we'll be watching. Uh-huh. Put it that way.
Well, so let's just jump right into this second article. The first article, again, you wrote just recently or last about a couple weeks ago for Counterpunch was Oregon's governor and the grifters, green crony capitalism, and the other one more recently, just the other day, Oregon Governor Brown's to-do list, a Herculean task. So what's your purpose with this article here?
Well, when Governor Brown was inaugurated, in her little short speech she gave, she talked about transparency and restoring trust in the government. And so I started thinking about all these things that have happened that really need to be looked into, you know, and so I came up with a to-do list for how she could restore trust and transparency, and I sent it to her. Of course, I haven't heard back, but of course, it was published on counterpunch.org, which is oftentimes called the best political newsletter in the country. But started by my friends Alexander Coburn, who's no longer with us, the great Alexander Coburn, and Jeffrey St. Clair. I'm nowhere near the writer they are, but they'll publish my stuff, and I can get some of this information out. And so my to-do list, if you're going to do transparency, you got to take on this stuff. Somebody has to take on the cover-up Oregon scam. I mean, the Attorney General has sued Oracle, but she says that over $420 million were spent, and Oracle has sued us, and then it's come out that when Kitsopper appointed his campaign staff people to take over the website for Cover Oregon, and in order to downplay it hampering his reelection campaign rather than dealing with what happened there. I mean, this is another case where we've put out hundreds of millions of dollars and we have nothing there. And so my thing in this case, the bridge that we talked about, the Columbia River crossing, all this money that's gone out for tax credits, the governor really needs to set up an independent audit to find out, okay, who were the checks cut to? Who got wealthy on this? What did we get from it? You know, how much did we, the state, did we get from it? The air needs to be cleared on this. And
talking about accountability here.
Right. I'd also, you know, different subject, but I would definitely reexamine the so-called grand bargain where Kitsopper called the legislature into special session in order to give Nike a 30-year tax break, which is estimated at it's going to cost us between $500 million and $2 billion by the time it's over. And at the same time, they cut state workers' pension fund by $5 billion. And that was the grand bargain. But that needs to be looked into as well.
Well, let's go to a couple callers. We've had one caller at least waiting for quite a while. Helen, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, I want to say that I wanted to try to see what makes Miss Hayes tick. So I looked on the computer about her, and it was saying that she was from, I think of her as a scrapper. The reason why is because she was from Washington, and she lived in some sort of shack with her mother, and her mother got divorced from her husband and married the brother, and they had no water or electricity, so she left at the age of 16. And then later she went to college in Olympia and majored in environmental studies. And then she moved to Bend, and I think she was going to school there, but she was living in the car with two dogs. So I was, you know, when I saw about how she married somebody to make $5,000, I just thought, she had a hard life at the beginning, you know, and she wanted to make her life good. Her, she came from a family with mental illness and alcoholism too. So I just think that is, the beginning stage of her existence and how she was going to make herself into something. It's just an added thought.
Michael?
Yeah, I agree. That's a lot of that, but, lots of people grew up living off the grid without water, running water and energy back in that era, the back of the land era. I myself was doing that.
Really?
But
I don't think it was a hippie form, though. I think it was with alcohol. I think it was definitely maybe, I don't want to say poor white trash, but maybe. So I understand what you're saying in the hippie time, but I don't know if they were hippies or not. Maybe they were. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just pointing out that doesn't necessarily lead one to be so grasping. If you read some of the emails, some of the emails that I couldn't believe she sent to the governor on the where, you know, she was just clearly it was about her carving out well compensated future.
Well, like I say, reading that stuff, like I said, I think she was a scrapper. I think she started out that way. So I think there was a deficit in herself that she really needed to make a change. And it's interesting also that I couldn't find out the day she was born. They just gave it the year. So she's not going to let anybody know too much about her.
Right.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for calling. That's the nature of this culture, is it, you know, there's a deficit in just about all of us. And we, unfortunately, the ways we're, you know, the images we have from the very early age, what we're taught how to fill that deficit is consumer culture and grasping and, you know, following the lead of all the great capitalist role models that we have. And unfortunately, that's the reality. We're trying to change that reality, and it's not a pretty reality. And, you know, certainly we need to understand people's motivations. But in any case, we've all got our motivations, and it's interesting to hear that. I was struck too by, you know, her origins. You know, it's like if one was to write a book or a novel or something, that'd be like, well, you know, these are real serious issues. And the fact that renewable energy and really important, I mean, vitally important issues are on the line, which is what really galls me, you know, that now, you know, now like the right wing or whatever, you know, has legitimate, you know, or has an easier time like portraying, and they already do this. They did that with Solana, solar, you know, the whole, you know, the whole supposed climate gate in England. Any opportunity that the right wing has to paint, you know, to paint us and what we try to paint them as being corrupt or whatever, they do it. And so it's kind of tragic that this came at this time.
Right. That's one of the main reasons I decided to write it and get it out there and on the left. Is because you know we need to clean our own house too, you know, because otherwise they do that. You know, they're incredibly skilled at that. You're talking about going into people's origin if in writing a book. Well, I assure you there'll be some books on this. I have some friends who are movie directors, and I keep telling them, hey, this movie is writing itself, you know, and so.
So we got a couple more callers. Sean, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, guys. Thank you for all your work over the years. One of the reasons I used to love to look forward to reading Alexander Coburn's stuff, like either in The Nation or in Counterpunch, was that it seemed like his analysis was deeply rooted in a kind of old left Marxist analysis. And yes. It seems like in the name of practicality and pragmatism, that the ultimate greenwashing that's going on today is this notion of like, just be busy. You know, we've valorized activity over a really good analysis of what the problem is in the name of practicality and pragmatism. Naomi Klein, I think, has that book out, This Changes Everything. That's kind of a step in the right direction. But like Joel Covell, he had his book Enemy of Nature, and it seemed like he was very clear and very precise about a critique of the capitalist system itself. So I was wondering if you guys would riff a little bit on just, you know, come on, let's name it, let's put it out there. You know, like, we can't continue to have an economy based on perpetual growth. Mm-hmm. We have to move towards a planned economy. Take it from there, guys. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks. I say that all the time, that, the perpetual growth. In fact, that's one of my beefs with the 25 by 25 thing. It's based on the pro-growth economy, just like everything else. It's all based on consumerism rather than cutting back our consumption so we don't need all these coal plants and this and that. We just find some other way to fuel our consumption. But yeah, there's numerous critiques on that. There's the DeSmog blog, which is run by a guy, Steve Horn, out of Wisconsin, that's really onto this and brings that up a lot. There's a number of Canadian writers and activists. Corey Morningstar, she's on top of this. If you Google her work, a lot of people are onto it. It's a industrial society. And Alex Coburn and I, you know, we had this little debate on this because, you know, I would always point out that, you know, Gaia didn't do all that well under the Soviet Union either, you know. So I'm not so sure that it's the planned economy versus the consumer economy. Something else has to happen there that's more, you know, actually really is sustainable.
Well, maybe it's like the kind of planning that you do. But, well, that's a big conversation. Yeah. So, you know, I wanted to talk about another thing. But before we go to that, let's go to our other caller who's waiting. Lee, you're on the air.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to address the issue of biomass as fuel and consider it one mm-hmm. of the most absurd greenwashings as ever invented. I'm a wood technologist, and I used to work at the Forest Products Department at Oregon State University, and I'm the lead author of a publication that came out of there called Hardwoods of the Pacific Northwest. And in my viewpoint, the forest products forestry industry out here is locked in a softwood mentality. And what I'm afraid of is that the hardwoods, which are predominantly considered weed species, are going to be sacrificed for biofuel. There was a recent push to consider biomass fuels as biogenic carbon dioxide. I don't know if anybody can wrap their head about that, but you know, basically, the EPA would not consider such emissions as CO2, mm-hmm. Contributory towards climate change. I'm afraid that what they're going to do is go in and just convert the hardwoods into, you know, fuel, and as a result, as Chris Andre says, forests are not tree farms, but they're going to harvest the hardwoods for fuel and totally disrupt the biodiversity within forests.
Yeah, they're already doing it in the U.S. Southeast. There's massive amount of chipping going on for biomass.
Yeah, basically what they're going to do is run whole tree chippers into the forests and just, you know, strip them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The new frontier.
I don't think the public is aware of the potential. You know, they think that it's a really good idea. But when you're talking about, you know, big leaf maple, California black oak, chinkapin, Oregon ash, Oregon white oak, madrone, tan oak, and just, you know, eliminating those species for fuel, it's just insane.
Right. And you touched on the fact that the government is declaring biomass burning to be carbon neutral in some way. It's really interesting that the Business Journal, Oregon Business Journal, you can go to their website, they have maybe one of the best articles I've ever read on it called The Carbon Calculus, because they're trying to get on top of it. But one of the things that stood out incredibly to me, that they had the top nine carbon polluters in the state, and of course the Boardman coal plant was number one, but the next four of them were all biomass plants.
Incredible. Well, thank you so much for calling me. Did you have any other...
I just hope that somehow the public can be aware that the only way that we're going to resolve this is to reduce the amount of energy that we actually consume.
Oh, heaven forbid.
Yes.
Thank
Amen.
You.
Right.
Thank you so much for calling, Lee. And do we have one more caller there? Jack, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yeah.
Yeah, the what's happening with the biomass issue is really shocking. It's exactly the opposite thing that should be happening. I don't know how closely you follow the climate polemic in the alternative blogs or whatever, but to my mind, the most forward thinking about the whole issue are people like Freeman Dyson, who has studied. He was involved in the first climate science studies at Oak Ridge, and we're talking 40 years ago. And that's just about that time they were working on the energy budget issues and come to a conclusion that they don't really know what's going on. And so the modelers, the computer modelers, come on board. And they get all the money, but he said what he concluded with the people he's working with is that land use is the solution. That the way the land is being used impacts the carbon budget in the atmosphere more than anything. And converting biological material into electrons, as you put it, is exactly the opposite thing that should be going on. The carbon needs to be going back into the earth, and there's an enormous potential for this, and you achieve it with land use practice, changing land use. He points out simple things like if you can farm without plowing, yeah, it makes a huge difference. You know, and there are ways to do these things. And adaptation, we spend so much on mitigation, for example, whereas dikes around New Orleans makes it. that's a small investment and makes a huge difference. There are big minds working on these issues and approaching them in very practical ways. Unfortunately, as your guest points out, the green crony capitalism is pouring so much money into so-called high-tech mitigation solutions. I think that it's just too tempting, all the money that's there. Oversight is what we need. We need oversight, and we need to use to be thinking about practical solutions, consulting people like world famous physicist Freeman Dyson. People will listen to him. People like this. So, I don't know. Have you heard? You're probably involved in this polemic, so I don't know. What do you think about that?
Which polemic is that?
Oh, well, it's about how do you deal with this carbon budget issue? You know, do you throw huge amounts of money at high tech, or do you start looking at practical, practical, affordable ways of dealing with it? Like I said, land use.
Yeah, well, I mean, none of these things are easy. I mean, our entire, you know, the entire way we organize our lives economically and technologically and infrastructurally are implicated in continuing along the same path, whether it's industrial agriculture, whether it's continued poor, you know, concrete. Concrete's like the major contributor, you know, in terms of industrial production.
Not to mention, concrete is incredibly carbon intensive, and people don't know that. In those nine top polluters that I talked about, one of them was a big concrete.
Yeah, exactly.
It takes an enormous amount of coal to make concrete and rebar.
Right.
So let's build with wood instead of burning wood for electrons. Let's use the resource of our forests in construction instead of concrete,
and not export them as raw logs, and not throw away these beautiful old buildings into the dumps, which I see. I used to work briefly for a salvage lumber operation and denailed a whole bunch of boards, but you know, still the majority still goes to the landfill, and on and on and on. I mean, tearing down buildings and buildings. So yeah, let's. Thank you very much for calling.
Exactly what I'm talking about. The practical, down to earth, level headed solutions. Okay.
Right.
So you're welcome.
All right, thanks.
Yeah, Jack. I wanted to point out to you that you know this weekend is the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference at the University of Oregon. It's the nation's oldest environmental law conference. And about 3,000 to 4,000 attorneys and activists and policy wonks and politicians will be there. And if you can go online and look at the agenda, and there's a lot of panels that are discussing land use, changes to land use. John Talberth from here in Portland, his organization is going to make a presentation on how to reform the Oregon Forest Practices Act so that stuff like these raids on the state forest can't take place. There's people working on that end of it as well. There's all sorts of The agenda is incredible. There's a lot of Native people coming from around the country. Native lands have borne the brunt of our energy addiction for way too long. Native people are coming to try to enlist our help to stop pipelines from going across their lands, uranium mines. Recently, the defense bill that Obama signed that was passed gives away the Oak Flats sacred lands of the San Carlos Apache in Arizona to mine copper. That's going to go into renewable energy products. And so all that's going on, and I highly recommend anybody who wants to come to that, it's great. And certainly go online and look up the agenda. People are trying to work on it from all these various angles.
That's the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference, PIELC, starting tomorrow afternoon in Eugene. There's a whole other subject I wanted to get into, but you know, we got to... Our callers are calling up faithfully, and we'd like to hear what they have to say. Go ahead. Susanna, you're on the air.
Hi. So I've been commenting in Clatsop County, which is supposed to be the best place in the world to grow Douglas fir, about leaving them to grow and have carbon sequestration, and that every 5 years after the age of 30, they double in board footage. And to me, it makes perfect sense. You let a tree grow at least another 5 years, maybe, hopefully 10 to 15, and making no headway. I mean, I can get a little spark out of an audience when it's talking about forestry issues, but for 2 years, I've not been strongly commenting, but, you know, going to meetings in the county and talking about it, forestry meetings. And there should be a huge push for carbon sequestration, carbon capture. And you get all so much more wood and lumber, and yet getting nowhere. And I wonder why. And then just one last comment. I think a huge problem with not cutting trees for taxes is just the whole tax structure and funding. And then what he had said about, I think Nike's getting more tax offset that big business aren't paying their taxes, and that's the bottom of it, really. Big businesses aren't paying their taxes. It's on property taxes and the funding of schools by forests. Anyway, that's all.
Thank you so much for calling.
Yeah, Susanna, I fully agree with you on the carbon sequestration, and I'm kind of perplexed at why the state hasn't set up a system of using the state forests as carbon sequestration and getting the offsets that, you know, like U.S. Airways flies all over spewing carbon, and they buy carbon offsets You know, well, why isn't the state cashing in on that? I think there might be even more money in that than cutting the trees for the bored feet. And one of the things is they really aren't looking for bored feet anymore. They're looking for chips. I was in Coos Bay recently, and right down on the docks, they have an operation that's cutting up whole logs into chips, putting them on ships, and then sending them to Asia to burn for fuel or turned into particle board or something. But you're right on the tax structure. That's the underlying problem here. The reason all these Democratic politicians want to up the cut, the reason that Kitzhaber got involved in it, the DeFaggio, and this, is because you hear about all these counties that are going broke. All these timber counties, the distressed timber counties, they've been getting millions and millions in subsidies out of the federal taxpayers for the past, you know, decade or so. And now that that pot of money is drying up, so they want to start cutting the forest and give away. The reason why every single one of these counties that's going broke, they have a special sweetheart deal with their largest landowners, and they barely tax them at all. And the largest landowners are big timber on their own private holdings. And so that's a big part of it. So the Democrats, rather than force the right people to pay the taxes, they would just rather see the larger pool of taxpayers pick up the costs, whether it's the state taxpayers or the federal taxpayers. At the same time, close to 100% of all the trees cut on those private timberlands are being exported as a raw product. And, you know, they want to tell you that spotted owls cost all the timber jobs. Well, let me tell you, as a former mill worker myself, a lot of the mill workers know the story. The jobs were exported. And that's just where we're at. You know, they claim it's for jobs and to help these counties that are going broke. Well, there's a whole lot of other stuff going on that could solve that problem.
Okay, we only have 5 minutes left, and all of a sudden we got a couple more callers. Let's at least try to squeeze one more. And Nate, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to talk to the subject of the biomass, and the focus being using the timber products as the feedstock for this process. To me, it sounds like some sort of agent provocateur, like where the right wing is getting in and using this as another means to cut down our forest. I think we're losing focus here on what could be biomass feedstock, and that would be hemp, regular garbage, leaf matter, stuff that we collect here in the city streets. I think that it's always, we lose focus on thinking of these things as the big problem, and we need to bring it back to the small and local. Do things small, start small, do with what we can. My point is basically hemp for feedstock for biomass rather than forest products.
Well, I just want to address that briefly. I mean, obviously we're looking at what seems to be an intractable solution. Things are coming down really fast. Climate change is really kicking in. Who knows what the future is going to look like? But in any case, whatever solution is going to have to be, as you said, a decentralized, a mosaic mm-hmm. approach. Where I lived in Italy for 14 years, there are some interesting experiments of these small scale operations where people like a school and like art gallery complex converted to, you know, using locally prunings from local trees to fuel a small scale chip burner to fuel that. And that something like that can make sense if it's done on a small scale. You know where it's coming from. It is sustainable because every year they have to prune those trees. So yeah, that kind of thing can make sense. Hemp, other things. But it's got to be part of a mix. You can't look for these huge technological fixes that basically divert attention from the real problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got it. Anyway, I wanted to plug a couple more things here. There's a book called Green Illusions by author Ozzie Zenner, and I highly recommend that book. And it goes into all the various things that we've been trying. And of course, the hemp one, I'm way on board that. I want to try that, see what happens. But at the same time, monocropping anything has its problems too. And I have a really good friend who's a movie director who's working on he's a documentarian working on a documentary on energy. And I can't give out too much more about it, but once it comes out, I hope to be here with him and Paul, and we'll talk about it a lot more at length.
Yeah, well, again, this weekend coming up, the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference, Michael and I are going to be there. If you can come down for even an afternoon or a day, it's a great place to meet folks. We've put out some resources. There's other organizations I'll try to refer to on our website, kboo.fm. Sorry to our last caller that we couldn't squeeze in. Try to call a little bit earlier in the hour next time. Thank you so much, Michael. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Paul.
All right. This has been Wednesday Morning Talk Radio, and this is a song by a group trio from France called Greenwashing. This is KBOO Portland.
On cache les galets sous le sable, on veut des plages de sable blanc, du réseau pour nos portables, on voudrait quatre bars tout le temps, des orgies raisonnables, des grands échangeurs de béton et des amis toujours joignables.
On veut des baleines et du thon, on veut des green,
green, green, green, green, green, green, washing. C'est nous les astres, les Tokyo du marketing.
On veut des green, 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 washing.
On veut de l'eau toujours qui coule et des rides un peu moins creusées.
On veut de la jeunesse en poudre et puis de la neige en été.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for qualified candidates to fill two vacant board seats. The KBOO Board of Directors invites qualified KBOO members who are interested in becoming a board member to submit a candidate statement no longer than 500 words, which should include the applicant's experience, information about previous board or coalition experience, and why they want to serve on the KBOO Board of Directors. Please email your candidate statement to Timothy Welp at kboocommunity@gmail.com by March 13, 2015. Candidates should also plan on being present at the March 23rd, 6 p.m. KBOO Board of Directors meeting to present a short statement about why they are interested in joining KBOO Board of Directors. Again, KBOO is looking for qualified candidates to serve on the Board of Directors. Application due March 13th and public presentation